In this weekend's episode, C-SPAN's Washington Journal takes a deep dive into two policy debates that dominated Washington this week: the debt ceiling standoff and the end of Title 42, the pandemic-related measure that restricted asylum seekers at the southern border. First, Andrew Seely, president of the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, discusses the end of Title 42, its impact, and the Biden administration's plan to deal with the expected influx of migrants now that the restrictions have been lifted. Then Shai Akabas, economic policy director at the Bipartisan Policy Center, on the debt limit stalemate and his analysis of the so-called X date, the date in which the government is unable to pay its bills. Now, Migration Policy Institute President Andrew Seely on Title 42, that pandemic-related border policy that ended this week.
You know, I think the assumption of Title 42, the way it's usually talked about in the press, you know, and this is true on the left and the right, is like it's the toughest measure ever implemented at the border, right? It's no tolerance, we just send people back to Mexico, which is what's allowed to do, right? As though people haven't entered the country. In reality, it's turned out not to be a great enforcement method, and it's been somewhat unpredictable. Some of that's the application, but in reality, a lot of people get in. The fact that people get sent back to Mexico and not to their countries of origin mean that it is, you know, for a migrant perspective, actually is sometimes preferable, right? People prefer being sent back to Mexico rather than put on a plane back to their country. And from people who are concerned about asylum and protection, it's a problem too because it doesn't allow any access to asylum. And so I think it's kind of worn out its welcome. Both because it doesn't give people access to asylum, but also because it just doesn't work as enforcement.
It was done under when the country was suffering from COVID the most. Was that an accurate application of it at the time?
You know, I think it was a justifiable application. You know, I was a skeptic at the time, but I think you can make a case during a pandemic the same way we stop mobility of all sorts. You can make a case of why people shouldn't come into the country, right? And it'd be easier to return them. But it's kind of outlived its usefulness as a public health measure. It stayed on because people think it's a tough border control measure. But I actually think it's got so many holes in it at this point that it's not fair on one side, but it's also not very effective on the other.
What happens Thursday?
Thursday, 11:59 p.m., all chaos reigns. The return to what the way things were, except that the numbers are not the way they were before. The numbers back until 2018 were much lower. There's a period in American history where they were higher in the early 2000s. But in recent memory, the numbers were a lot lower. They started to go up in 2018. The Trump administration struggled with the rise in numbers. They eventually got them down by using Title 42. But now they're going to go back to regular order, which requires deciding if people have a valid asylum claim, and if not, putting them on an airplane back to their country of origin, doing a formal deportation. It is a lot more time. You know, it takes a lot more time to do this. There are a lot of people coming, and it's not clear if the U.S. government has the capacity to process everyone who's going to arrive at the border, you know, in a fair and you know, efficient way. And I think you're going to see a lot of chaos in the first few days because of that.
Secretary Mayorkas said that after Thursday, we go from Title 42 to something called Title 8, mm-hmm. different processes there. Can you explain the differences?
Sure. Title 8. So Title 42 was really this exceptional measure that allowed the U.S. to expel people as though they hadn't entered the country. And occasionally they did expel people to their countries of origin, you know, with what they call delayed Title 42. But you didn't have to do any much process here. Now they have to do process, which is the way the immigration system is set up under Title 8, usually. And that means that if someone comes in, they have to, if they ask, if they say that they have a fear of returning to their country, the U.S. has to do something about it. They have passed a rule, they're about to announce a rule, we think, that is going to say, if you come between ports of entry and you don't have an appointment, then we have a presumption of ineligibility for asylum. We'll do a quick check, but we're not going to do the whole process. But they do have to log them in. They do have to, you know, do some process to see if they have a question of fear of being returned. And then to deport them, they actually have to formally do paperwork and put them on a plane and return them to their country of origin. They can't. They will be able to send some people back to Mexico. Mexico has said they'll still take people back. So I think they'll be doing a lot of that still the first few days. But eventually, the idea is you're supposed to return them to country of origin.
For those border state residents,
yes.
How have they, what's their experience been like under the past couple of years? What are they expecting after Thursday?
You know, so it's changed over time. So at the beginning, there was just massive numbers of people staying in border communities and got very chaotic. What the Biden administration learned how to do working with local governments is to how to process them quickly and get them onto their final destination. So usually with city governments or shelters helping them figure out how to get to the nearest bus station, keep going. And so the numbers went way down. I think they're expecting a huge deluge because, you know, the government's not going to be able to process people in the regular way. And I think that you know, at least for a few days, maybe a few weeks, that sort of orderly process is going to break down. And we were just in Texas at the border. In fact, my colleagues went from San Diego on one side all the way to Brownsville, and I joined them for the Texas part of the trip. And we were able to go to Border Patrol stations and to ports of entry and to meet with local governments and NGOs, and fascinating. But, you know, it's become an orderly process. We were quite impressed with that. But I expect most of this will break down just with the sheer numbers and the fact that it's going to take them longer to process people, plus the fact the numbers are going to go up because people aren't certain if they can get in, and they're not going to be able to do the orderly process for a bit.
Secretary Mayorkas in Brownsville last week, Brownsville, Texas, and during a press conference, he talked about what happens afterward and how the administration has been preparing for it. I want to show you a little bit of what he had to say and then get your comments on it.
We are building pathways at the same time. At the same time, we will deliver consequences for individuals who arrive at our southern border irregularly. That is our commitment and our obligation as a way of cutting the smugglers out and taking care of the safety and needs of individuals who qualify for relief. In a post-Title 42 environment, we will be using our expedited removal authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code. That allows us to remove individuals very quickly. We will, by May 11th, finalize the rule that we published in a proposed format that provides that individuals who do not access our lawful pathways will be presumed to be ineligible for asylum and will have a higher burden of proof to overcome that presumption of ineligibility.
So, Andrew Seeley, that's the preparation, but like you're saying, the experience might be different.
The experience will almost certainly be different. The numbers have gone up since last week. So here's what they want to do. And I think it's a smart strategy on paper. Now, you know, anything the government does on paper, you got to figure out how you put in practice, and there's often a difference there. But the idea is this. They've tried to open up as many legal pathways as possible, allow people, you know, there are needs in the labor market in this country for people to come here and work. We're seeing it right now. So they're trying to make those as wide as possible. Hard to do in legislation we have, but they've stretched what they've got a little bit. They're trying to do processing for protection needs for people that are actually running for their lives in the region. They're going to open up some centers in Guatemala, several centers in Guatemala and Colombia, and then some other countries to screen people ahead of time and then skip the smuggler and take them right to the U.S. if they have protection needs. And if not, tell them that they're not likely to get asylum in the U.S. And then they're going to try and be clinical at the border. And if someone doesn't show up with a visa or a permit to enter the country, or an appointment for an asylum appointment already ahead of time, they're going to process them an expedited removal, Title 8, which means they will do a cursory check to see if they have protection needs, and if not, put them on their plane back to their country of origin. And they assume that over time, the more people get returned, the more people will realize that they can't get to the border and get across. It'll bring the numbers down, and the more people are going to use these other legal pathways.
Again, some of those things to expect after May 11th. He talked about those regional processing centers in Guatemala and Colombia initially, that streamlined family reunification process for Cubans and Haitians, and expanded family reunification for Salvadorians, Hondurans, and Guatemalans, Colombians. It would double the refugee resettlement from the region and increasing those numbers from something called CBP1. It's their app. That's been coming into a issue as far as the app is concerned. Can you describe how that works?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that if you get to northern Mexico, you can get on this app and you can schedule an appointment for asylum. Well, right now it's been an exception to Title 42. It'll become, as of May 12th, it'll become the asylum appointment. So the app has some glitches, right? People can't always get on it. They get kicked out. It has trouble recognizing darker faces. It has trouble recognizing children. They might be able to fix all that eventually. The bigger problem is it's still a draw for people to go to northern Mexico to try and get on the app and try and get to the United States. And so they know they have to begin to process people for protection earlier before they get a smuggler. I mean, the idea, many of us love the idea that any human being who's in danger can show up at our border and be able to ask for protection. I think there's something, it's an international law, it's a beautiful idea. It's something that was built after World War II as a way of protecting people against authoritarian governments. The reality is it's become a really hard process to manage for most countries these days, because anyone can show up and ask for asylum. And so what they're trying to do is push it back earlier, identify people with real need. I still think the app's going to be a draw to the northern border, but at least they're going to try and catch some of these people earlier on before they hire a smuggler and run.
That was Andrew Seeley, president of the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Next, Shai Akabas of the Bipartisan Policy Center discusses the House debt limit stalemate and potential impact of a default. We started by asking him how concerned he was about the current standoff.
The two sides are really still using mostly their original talking points, and we're going to need the two sides to move off of those in order to reach an agreement. So I'm concerned because we're months and possibly even only weeks away from defaulting on our obligations as a country, which is a position that the United States should really never be in. But we've looking back at history, our leaders have always managed to come to resolution before the worst consequences have hit us. So I'm cautiously optimistic that they'll do so again.
The front page story in The Washington Post, the wrap up of that meeting yesterday, laid out a potential path forward here. I just want to bounce it off you. Biden aides have left open the possibility of a deal on government spending that also ends the impasse over the spending limit. The scenario would allow both sides to claim victory, with Republicans saying that they secured cuts and White House officials maintaining that they took steps needed to avert default. Is that a path that you see as a possibility?
I think that's definitely the most likely outcome here. We have right now the two sides sort of talking past one another. The president is saying that he is insisting on a clean debt limit increase, meaning nothing else attached to it. But there aren't the votes in Congress for that. And the House has passed a debt limit increase along with about $5 trillion of savings that they would like to see. There's not the votes for that either. So we need to see something in the middle. And the president has said he's not going to negotiate over the debt limit itself. And that's sort of where the rub is, where the Republicans have said they're going to insist on specific savings for in exchange for the debt limit. The president has said he's willing to negotiate about the budget, but not about the debt limit. So I think it really comes down to how the two sides are describing this. And if they can get past that rhetoric, then they can find a deal there on the substance and make sure that we're also making good on all of our obligations.
And the question is whether they have time to get past those. Explain what the X date is.
Sure. We at the Bipartisan Policy Center have been working on the debt limit for over a decade now, and we try to serve as sort of a third-party objective voice in this discussion because the Treasury Department, of course, has estimates of when we will run out of cash to pay all of our bills. But because it's politics and because there are members on the opposite side, those estimates are not always interpreted as objective. And so we try to play that validating voice from the outside to help give members of Congress the information that they need. What we call the X date at the Bipartisan Policy Center is when the government would run out of cash on hand to meet all of its obligations. Right now, the Treasury Department is using what are called extraordinary measures. These are sort of accounting maneuvers that buy a little bit of additional time for policymakers to work out a deal. Those measures have been in place since January, and we expect at PPC that they will run out sometime between early June and early August. So at most months, perhaps only weeks away, which is, again, quite concerning. This is analysis, I should say, that I do with my colleagues Rachel Snyderman and Arianna Fano at the Bipartisan Policy Center. It takes a lot of work because we're analyzing hundreds of billions of dollars of cash flows that come in and out of the government each month. And it's really important to acknowledge that not even the Treasury Secretary knows what day it will be that we fail to meet all of our obligations.
Why don't they know that? Why isn't this easier to predict? Do we not know when things are going to get paid?
This is a little different from what a lot of viewers are probably familiar with in a government shutdown. So in a government shutdown, there's a specific date through which Congress has authorized or appropriated spending. And once that date comes, if they don't make new spending decisions, there's just no authority to spend more money. And we know when that date's going to be because it's written in law. And if they don't meet that date, then there's a government shutdown and non-essential employees get sent home and some government services shut down until there's a deal reached. In this case, what we're dealing with is the U.S. has set out all of its spending priorities. Congress has passed bills, including entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, and also the annual discretionary programs, annual funding programs for this year. But there isn't enough borrowing capacity in order to meet all of them. We're running a deficit as a country. We're spending more than we're taking in. And the difference is made up from borrowing from the public. And if we don't have the ability to borrow more money from the public by issuing debt, then we can't meet all of our obligations. So that's why it's difficult to estimate this, because we need to figure out all the cash flows of the government that happen over the course of each day, each week, and each month, and then figure out when they're going to actually run out of those cash flows and hit effectively ground zero.
Is there any way you can be more specific of June through August? Do you have kind of can you narrow that a little bit that you feel more confident about?
Yeah, so a lot of folks are wondering why we have so broad a range right now, and it's a really interesting question. So we see a real danger point in early June, because that is before the Treasury Department will get in quarterly tax revenues that are due on June 15th. Once they get those in, that'll help buoy them for a period of time. And then there's actually an additional extraordinary measure that becomes available at the end of June that will help get them a little further. So it's sort of a two-part window here. Either...
So there's a danger zone on the front end.
There's a danger zone on the front end. If they manage to get past that, which is risky, but if they manage to get past that, then it's likely we'll be at least into July before we reach the X date, and then we're looking at sometime in July or at the latest, perhaps early August.
What do you think this does to our credit standing? Do you see a potential of another credit downgrade?
Well, we saw that in 2011, of course. That was the last time we had this really all-out brawl over the debt limit, and S&P downgraded us right around that. It was both because we were threatening not to meet all of our obligations on time and because we showed that there really wasn't a way that we could deal in a bipartisan manner with our fiscal challenges. Of course, we have a very large debt as a country. It's almost 100% of GDP, which it's only been once throughout our history, which was after World War II. And it's headed sky high. It's headed up to 200% of GDP over the next several decades if we don't do anything about it. And S&P acknowledged both that fiscal reality and the fact that we were playing brinksmanship with the debt limit and downgraded us as a result. Various rating agencies have put out warnings to say that if we see that kind of thing again or if we go past the X date in a worst-case scenario, they could downgrade further. And I think that would be really dangerous for the country because it could lead to increases in borrowing costs, drops in equity markets, lots of other consequences that we can't really foresee.
Have we given them any more confidence in the past 12 years that we can deal in a bipartisan way with our fiscal challenges in this country?
The short answer is no, we have not. And that is really troubling because our debt continues to rise. We all know that it's a problem. And yet there doesn't seem to be the political will to do anything about it. So we've had various debt ceiling episodes between 2011 and now. None of them have come quite as close to the brink as we did in 2011 or as this one could take us. But we have come within, you know, weeks or months of not making good on all of our obligations. And I think when credit rating agencies are looking at the United States or at any country, they have to decide how likely is it that the government is not going to make good on those debts. And if we come within weeks or months, every year or two of that risk, there's a natural reaction from them to say that you're no longer the gold standard of, you know, credit in the world.
That was Shai Akabas, Economic Policy Director at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.